Big Horror and Little Podcast is a proud member
of the Legion Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome
back
to the fourth episode of
Big Horror.
Big Trouble, sorry, just thought I was Duncan there for a minute. big Horror in Little Podcast.
Yeah, so we've been away for over 4 weeks. Slight hiatus, but now we're back.
Yeah, we just decided to come back with a slightly new format. We're going to change the format every 3 episodes.
Yeah, well, let's not commit to that. Just
in case. We are committing to it because we've recorded 3.
Yeah.
Well, today's going to include a special on Rob Zombie.
That's true. Well, the next 3 episodes.
The next 3. Hence, we're going to try and keep a formula.
Yeah.
But actually, fuck that. The Halloween show will probably be quite bigger than this episode. So
basically, this episode today is going to include an interview with one of Rachel's friends, who's a big fan of Rob Zombie. We talked about 3 of Zombie's movies, and we're going to show you our first instalment of that today. But what we're going to talk about mainly is, should we talk about what we've been doing? First of all, since we've been off?
We've been to France and that, haven't we?
That's pretty good.
That was all good countryside.
It was nice.
Very rural, lots of chickens and cocks walking round.
Stuck in the middle of nowhere.
And there were a few roosters.
Yeah. Yeah, in the middle of nowhere. In a 300-year-old house we were staying.
Ghost free.
Didn't sense any, did you?
I'm ghost free.
Yeah.
Fortunately. Unlike, I was willing for one.
Mm.
Actually.
Ghost free, unlike the thing we're going to discuss. That was good. I managed to transition into that.
I can see what you did there.
Oh yeah, we went Asda as well just now, didn't we?
Oh yeah, that was
God. Asda on a Sunday, only open till 4 o'clock. So many people.
Yeah.
And they were giving away tiny little triangles.
Of crumpet.
And the people around it like flies.
It was like a flock of ducks, wasn't it, when you go feed the ducks?
Vultures. Just for a little piece of free crumpet. It
was blocking up the aisle, but we batter-rammed through them, didn't we?
Oh God, it was unbelievable. That's why we do online shopping.
Yeah.
I
don't actually know why anybody goes down and subjects himself to the scum of the Asda. It was Asda, I guess. But. Yeah.
Okay, so what we're going to talk about tonight is it's BBC's Screen 1 Ghost Watch. Now, this was aired on Halloween, 31st of October 1992, on BBC One. Kind of gone down in history, really, hasn't it? As one of the kind of biggest hoaxes of all time.
It was one of those, obviously, one of those first things that really, really fooled people. And I asked my mum and dad yesterday if, obviously, they were the adults and I was a child, if they also thought it was real, and they did.
Yeah.
Obviously, they couldn't remember enough about it. I'm sure as it gets towards the end, they probably then realised. But
yeah, I mean, it was advertised as being real. Basically, Screen 1 used to be a drama that was 1 hour long, but this was advertised as a documentary. So even though it was under the banner of Screen 1, because it had real presenters, people that were on regular...
All the classics.
Yeah, all the classics.
Michael Parkinson there to add some serious credibility to
add some realism to it. Now, apparently the BBC, at the last minute, bottled it and decided that they needed to tell everyone it was fake because they were panicking that it would cause too many problems. But all they really did was put a listing in the TV Times and the Radio Times, which was like a TV listings magazine at the time, and they put a cast list of the people that were in the show. But not many people kind of read TV Times and Radio Times.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't do a really good job of trying to let people know, did they? Because otherwise they would have said at the beginning of the show, everything you're about to see is actually fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they did that to cover themselves. They wanted to scare people, didn't they?
Of course they did. And what they did at the beginning, it had, you know, with Michael Parkinson, who is not an actor, he's an actual presenter who's been on the BBC for literally, 40 years?
Yeah, I'd say he's really credible.
And then all they wrote underneath was by Stephen Volk. Now, it didn't say written by Stephen Volk. Mm. It could have been directed by, it could have been produced by. So the BBC try and say that they put a writing credit at the beginning.
Yeah.
But saying by somebody, for me, doesn't mean it's a writing credit. That could mean it was that was the director or anything. So as far as you're concerned, coming in watching this, it was real.
Okay, so you got Michael Parkinson in the studio. And then you have them flitting back and forth to the house with a setup, crowd outside, and Sarah Green, who was a famous kind of children's and then obviously charity type presenter at the time.
Yeah, so it was an on-air investigation of a haunted house.
A mother and two children who were about 9 and 12.
And basically they were saying that poltergeist activity was believed to be taking place in their house. And then we start to see footage and interviews with the neighbours. So yeah, like you say, it's a mother, isn't it? And two children living in this house, and they're experiencing real paranormal activities in the
house.
And
they have an expert in the studio with Michael Parkinson who claims she'd been there to spend, you know, weeks with that house.
Yeah, so she's an expert.
And she'd witnessed many poltergeist-type behaviours.
Yeah, so you've got them in the studio. So Michael Parkinson's who had the total realism that this is a documentary. And Michael Parkinson's actually really pessimistic as well, which is great.
Yeah, he's sceptical, isn't he?
Yeah, totally. Because if you had everyone on board with it, it'd be too obvious, I think, that it was, do you know what I mean? Whether if you've got some people that are sceptic and saying, oh, this is a load of nonsense. And then obviously you've got the specialist who spent a lot of time with the family trying to convince them that it's real.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of flip back, don't we, between in the studio, at the house. There's like a big film crew outside the house and there's various neighbours and people, aren't they, gathered as like onlookers to kind of watch this.
And then they leave Sarah Green in the house with the girls, the camera crew, and their mother sort of comes outside into a bus to monitor what's going on while the night progresses. And it obviously starts fairly tamely, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's not a lot happening. We see some footage of like the children's bedroom and apparently kind of noises banging and the girls screaming, but all stuff that really could be explained. You know, you don't see any kind of real paranormal activity. The first thing you do see is like a ghostly apparition in their bedroom.
Standing near the curtain.
Standing at the curtains. So now, also, to add to the realism, we've also got a phone in.
Yeah.
So you can phone in, and what they did was they put the same phone number that they used for all the other BBC phone-ins at the time, the 0818118181,
yeah.
And kids will remember that because on the children's shows to ring in for competitions and stuff.
Yeah, they used to have a jingle.
Now, apparently you could ring in, and they're actually taking real phone calls from people.
Yeah.
And then it got to the point when
some of them were like, oh, my table's exploding, it's exploding.
Yeah, so you have people calling in, but also, again, Michael Parkinson was being really sceptical, saying, look, whatever's happening in your house, it's nothing to do with this. And then they obviously had some pre-recorded people calling in as well, where it gave us some really good exposition to what was happening within the house.
So the history of the house.
Yeah, the history of the house.
And obviously bad things that happened there.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, it kind of works out through various exposition. It's interviewing with the neighbours. I mean, there's a bit where they talk to the neighbours in the street and it's quite dark. They talk about a park right next to the house where like a mutilated, like an animal, a pregnant animal was found slit open and it was pregnant.
It was kittens pulled out, wasn't it?
I think it was a dog, so the puppies were like strewn all over the park. Like quite dark stuff, really. So the exposition, basically, it turns out that there's the kids have nicknamed this ghost Pipes because it bangs on the pipes. But what we kind of realise,
it's Pipes, it's Pipes.
Yeah, Pipes, Mum. I mean, the kids, looking back, they're pretty good actors.
No, they are. They're good, the kids.
I mean, obviously, looking back now, there's no way we would have bought this as an adult. So I kind of feel privileged to have watched it as a kid to get the full benefit. I mean, it kind of makes me realise just how big of a horror fan I was. Because this was epic TV when I was 11. So I was obviously well into horror by 11, to the point where this was a massive TV event. It was on, like, after 9 o'clock, which is what they used to call the watershed.
We're laughing at apparently some of the criticisms where it's too close to the watershed.
Well, yeah, really bizarre thing, people complaining that it was too close to the watershed. Now, the watershed is the cut-off point, meaning anything after this is adult content. So it really doesn't matter whether it's 9:05 or 9:30. If you pass the watershed, you pass the watershed.
Yeah.
So you got to deal with it. Obviously, people were kind of really dealing with, you know, their children basically being terrified by this. So this guy Pipes basically turns out that really far back in history, the house was possessed was a woman called Mother Seddons, who was like a baby farmer, kind of child molester.
that sounds really bad, though.
I think he's laughing because the BBC now is well known to be full of paedophiles.
Yeah.
So this Mother Seddons, and apparently her spirit had got into this guy who they'd nicknamed Pipes. This guy called Raymond Tunstall, who was basically a child molester, and he said that this Mother Seddons had possessed him. And it turns out that he'd actually hung himself in this house with this family.
Yeah.
And he'd hung himself, and cats had started eating away at his body, and which is why they've also heard, like, cat noises, aren't they, in the house?
Yeah, really did, yeah.
And then we kind of get to see one of the kids is possessed. Not possessed, but there's, like, a demonic voice, isn't there?
Mm.
And coming from the girl, so the expert apparently takes the girl to like a specialist place where they get her to record voices.
Yeah.
And they have an expert say that none of these experts could match up her voice pattern with this demonic voice.
Yeah, there's anything within the voice, yeah.
And they play it in the studio, don't they? It's quite a creepy demonic voice.
Oh, yeah, it's really creepy. And then obviously the girl at the end wakes up and doesn't remember any of it when they play it back to her.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, she tries obviously to, you know, to replicate this voice. So it's really good. Building suspense. So we've got this ghost.
Because obviously she's been waking up with scratches all over her face.
That's another thing they then show you, don't they, that this girl at one point woke up with what looks like cat scratches all over her face for no reason. So because of the exposition that we've got and the building of the story, we now kind of know that there was like the ghost of a child molester that killed himself in the house. Cats played a big part.
Mm.
And obviously then you've got this demonic voice.
Yeah, so they cover all bases really well in terms of what you want in terms of a haunting.
It's really good at building story, but we only ever see it as like a backstory. We don't actually see anything really happening in the house, do we? It's all stuff that's been told retrospectively
at first, yeah.
Kind of weird shit starts happening in the house, weird noises. Mm. And then what they do, which is another really great thing that they did to add to the realism, Scream 1 stuff was only over an hour long. And obviously, the BBC knew all along that this programme was going to be an hour and a half, but they basically pretended to the audience that because stuff's now happening in the house, we're going to run over.
Yeah.
And we're going to run over the schedule. So the thing that was meant to be on after this is cancelled, and we're just going to keep the cameras rolling because stuff starts happening in the house.
I thought you was going to say then about the detour where they kind of proved that it was the girls rattling the pipes. So you think it's a complete and utter shambles.
Yeah, so that's kind of the first, it's almost like a hoax within a hoax, isn't it? They hear the pipes banging, which is apparently what the ghost does.
Mm.
And they see that it's one of the young girls.
They go back on the cameras, yeah.
And she's banging the pipes in the house.
Mm.
So then we go back to the studio.
Michael's like, told you. Michael Parkinson, all smug, is going,
this is just obviously a disturbed little girl. And the expert's saying, look, no, this isn't a disturbed little girl. They're just doing this because
they want to try and give you what you want.
Yeah, they know they're on TV and they want to give you what
you want. And they don't want to look like liars.
Yeah, exactly. So we're coming to what you now think is probably going to be the end of the show because it's almost been highlighted that there's a hoax.
Then the bit that finished us off.
No, but the first bit then is the camera goes back to the bedroom of the other sister and she's all of a sudden got these scratches.
Oh, yeah. That's not the bit that finished us off.
Yeah. So she's got these scratches all over her face.
She's in quite a trance.
Yeah, she's almost in a trance.
She's just staring.
And Michael Parkinson says, well, she's probably done that with her fingernails.
She's clearly got, she's clearly mentally ill.
Yeah, mentally ill little girl. But then they show her fingernails and she hasn't really got any. She's obviously bites her nails and she hasn't got any nails. Mm. So you're kind of wondering where these scratches come from.
Mm. It's quite eerie the way she's just staring.
Yeah, she's like she's in a trance, almost like she's been possessed and something's kind of held her down and scratched her all over her face.
Yeah.
So that's really when kind of shit starts to get real.
It does.
Because the whole time before that, you're not sure whether this is, just a disturbed family or...
Because obviously you start to get things like banging and they think they see something outside the patio.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Something smashes outside.
Yeah.
lots of small things than that you come to expect from hauntings.
Yeah, as, I mean, I tell you
what, build in suspense.
I tell you what they did do, which is that they showed us the night vision camera.
Yeah,
and they never use it.
Not to its potential.
Actually, it seems such a waste because they kind of introduced that they've got this night vision camera and they show us some night vision.
I mean, I've got a slightly different opinion on you in the sense that I kind of appreciate what they do with the night camera when we get to that point.
Okay.
But yeah, I get your criticism as well.
Yeah, and then we kind of get, basically, there's a really cool scene then when they're back in the studio and you can see everybody kind of chatting and getting on and nothing's happening in the house, and then they realise that the footage that they're being shown in the studio is actually a pre-recording.
It is.
Which then kind of leads you to believe that
something's in it.
That the demon's got into the equipment.
Yeah.
And he's kind of forcing people at home. It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great, yeah.
And then we kind of go back to the house and we just hear like this incredible like cats wailing, like really banging. Yeah, it's horrible. Like, good. Like a picture comes flying off the wall, and then the older sister who's been scratched in the face earlier all of a sudden starts talking in this
voice. She's in the corner as well, all huddled
in the corner, like the sound crew like put the microphone in her face and she just starts telling this like weird nursery rhyme. She says round and round the garden like a teddy bear in a demonic voice, and as a kid that was it.
And you said that was it. I'll start crying.
I shit myself. Because the scratches on the face was freaky enough, but she, you know, you think she could have done that herself because you don't actually get to see that. You just see, like, they rush into her bedroom because her sister says, oh, something's wrong with Susie, so they run in and you see the scratches. But once the demon voice happens, fuck me, that was, like, full on, I shit myself. I think I was on the verge of tears then at 11 thinking this is real. Because they do such a good job of building the suspense early on, and then obviously you get the fake hoax where you think, oh, it's not real, it's the kid all along. And then that shit happens.
Yeah. Because even though as a kid you kind of want to see something scary, there's that child part of you that still wants to know that you're in a safe kind of world.
Yeah.
Where maybe stuff doesn't exist, and then for a minute you really believe it.
Well, that's it, because you're so convinced this is BBC, it's Michael Parkinson, it's meant to be live and happening now. I mean, actually, as it happens, the footage of the house and everything was actually pre-recorded.
Yeah.
So the stuff with Michael Parkinson in the studio, they're reacting to pre-recorded footage, but you don't know that. You think this is totally real. Now, they go back to kind of a story earlier, because this guy that hung himself in their house, this ghost, this kind of manifestation of evil, almost.
Pipes.
He hung himself in their cellar.
Which is boarded up, isn't it?
So they boarded their cellar up, because they also tell a story earlier on that I forgot to say about the mum goes into the cellar and she gets trapped in there and she can feel this thing breathing on her.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they've boarded the cellar up, but then they start to hear banging and things coming from the cellar. So Sarah Green and the cameraman and the sound guy rip the little barricade bit of wood off the cellar and they go in there and the door slams shut.
Yeah.
And you get to see a brief glimpse of the ghost just as the door slams shut. And then we kind of go back to the studio. And then there's kind of everything, like the studio almost gets possessed. The lights start blowing out. Wind starts blowing through the TV studio. Cups and things start flying around and everything. And then there's like a huge explosion of light and you get to see like the ghost again standing in the studio now. Almost like it's invaded the studio.
Yeah. He said, fuck off.
And then Michael Parkinson actually gets possessed and he starts to do the nursery rhyme and the demon voice.
Yeah, that's kind of right at the end. Before that, there is use of the night vision, etc.
We don't see any ghosts on the night vision, do we?
We don't, but I still feel that the use of the night vision still builds a suspense because you're really expecting something.
Yeah.
No, they don't deliver, but sometimes the not delivering is as powerful.
Yeah, I suppose.
Because I was, even re-watching it, I was like thinking, oh shit, it's going to pop up at any point. I'm ready to do my little bob ski.
I'm ready to shit myself.
Okay, I've got my nappy on. Yeah.
So it's great because Michael Parkinson, at one point, when they're talking about this Mother Seddons, Michael Parkinson kind of, like, you know, he says, oh, that's not real, you know, come on, everyone, you know, this is getting a bit out of hand now. And then when he gets possessed by the demon, he says, you didn't believe the story about Mother Seddons. Almost like it's pretty fucking creepy. It gives me goosebumps now. I think really good because like you've got this ghosty. I'm going to post a picture up on the site of the guy that played the apparition pipes, because he's all kind of chewed away, like he's got blood coming out of his face, obviously, because we're supposed to believe that the ghost was eaten by cats because he was rotting in the cellar for so long. And in hindsight, which I kind of didn't realise until I looked this up on Wikipedia, this ghostly apparition appears quite a few times throughout the whole show. The first time is in the bedroom footage. And now it is quite obvious that you see him in the bedroom footage, but what they kind of cleverly do is when they show the footage back, it's not there. So you've seen the footage the first time.
Because they get the viewer, don't they? And so we'll look back at that footage for the viewer.
Yeah, what they do, somebody rings in. It's gone again. Someone rings in and says, when you showed that bedroom footage earlier, there was a ghostly image in the footage.
And they're like, oh, really? Oh, okay, that's...
And they're saying, no, surely not. No, that can't be right. And then they get the footage up, and it was there when you saw it the first time, but when they replay it, it's not there. And then they kind of show the footage again a bit later with it almost half faded in, half faded out. So it's kind of half there. So really good to confuse the viewer. And then when they're back in the studio and the psychologist, Dr. Pasco, plays the tape of the possession voice, he's in the background in the studio. The shadowy figure of this ghost is in the background of the studio. And then what's really creepy is when they're doing the story about the animal getting its stomach ripped open, when the camera like pans back to the house, the ghost is in the audience.
Not
the audience, but there's like a group of like bystanders.
We went back and had a look, didn't we?
And as the camera pans by, he's kind of there.
He's just there in the background.
With all his bloody face and really, really creepy stuff. And then obviously you've got the haunted bedroom under the stairs, which I said, and then he appears kind of in an explosion when he appears in the studio briefly.
Subtle.
Really subtle, but really well done. But I think it was a bit too subtle because I didn't spot it, and it wasn't. And even looking back, it's so fast. But it's nice because on rewatch, you kind of get a little bit extra. And I'll tell you what else that was pretty cool that happened as well. Like a bit of poltergeist activity, a perfectly round patch of water appears on the living room carpet. Which is pretty cool, because obviously when you drop water, it's never perfectly round, and you've got a perfectly round circle.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's like another kind of creepy thing that starts
happening. That's part of the build-up, really, isn't
it? But again, because you don't see that happen, it's not convincing. It's not until the demon voice that you actually witness with your own eyes, is it, that it really sort of kicks off. There's really subtle kind of paranormal activity happening throughout the show. Like, obviously, it's building the tension, isn't it? So I've got some behind the scenes stuff to talk about. There was a lot of complaints about this. People really, kicking off about it because people were absolutely terrified.
Bringing the devil out.
Yeah, because the way it kind of turned out is that it was almost like a big, the whole program was like a seance and this manifestation of evil. Then,
possessed,
it's almost like it was getting more powerful throughout the show as people were ringing in and getting involved at home. And obviously that
then, sucking up the energy.
Yeah, and like that accumulates to this, it basically possessing the live TV show at the end of it, Now, I don't know why people are complaining too much, because once that Michael Parkinson bit happens with him being possessed, we then go to the credits.
Yeah.
Where it tells you, that the daughter was played by this person, the mum was played by this person, the psychologist that they have in the studio was played by an actress who's subsequently...
It's a cast list.
It's a cast list. That's instantly going to make you realise. I mean, that I remember...
The thing is, though, I don't think you'd even notice at that point if you were that taken in by it.
What do you mean?
You wouldn't even really notice the cast list or whatever. You'd just be looking at each other going, oh my God.
No, but for me, that was when I breathed a sigh of relief.
What, as a kid?
Yeah.
You noticed that as a kid?
Well, yeah, because the credits started rolling, you could see that they're all actors.
Oh, see, I didn't even remember looking at the credits.
Yeah.
No, I think I was too busy running away.
So at what point did you realise it wasn't real?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Ever?
No, until I watched it again.
Right.
I wouldn't think I was aware of credits anyway when I was about 11.
Do you not think?
No, never used to wait. I'd stop watching something before the credits even rolled for me.
Right, because for me, that was like I say, that was the reassurance.
Even now, I turn a film off before the credits roll, really.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing is, they do that now. I don't know whether they always put something after the credits to kind of make you keep watching.
I expect my mum was like, let's just get you two to bed. It's not real. Ghosts don't exist, blah, blah, blah.
So you reckon your mum and dad were kind of convinced that it was real as well?
Well, I think I don't know. They don't remember enough about it, do they? But I'm sure that they suspected once Parkinson became... possessed that it was all a wind up, but trying to explain that to your terrified children, who believe they've seen stuff before their eyes, is it's quite a difficult task to be left with.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, for me, as soon as I saw that they're all actors, that was kind of big sigh of relief, because I thought, oh shit, if stuff like this can happen in London, then it can happen where I live. But basically, like I say, the reaction, it led from the BBC to put a 10-year-long ban on the programme ever being repeated. The ban's now been lifted, because you can get it on DVD and things now. Apparently, it did. Some people killed themselves as a result of this. Behind some information, there's an 18-year-old factory worker who suffered from learning difficulties with a mental age of 13, killed himself 5 days after the programme. Because they had, basically, his house had a faulty central heating system, which caused the pipes to knock. And he basically thought that pipes was in his house now, too.
Yeah, well, they can't really be responsible for that.
He left a suicide note reading, "If there are ghosts, then I will be with you as a ghost," to his mum and dad. And obviously the parents blame the BBC.
Easy to go and blame, isn't it?
Well, he obviously did cite that as kind of a
obviously, but he obviously had many issues that led him to...
Yeah, of course he did, yeah. So basically they're saying that Ghostwatch was a deliberate attempt to cultivate a sense of menace. They ruled that the programme was excessively disturbing and graphic, referring to the scratches on the kid's face and the reference to the mutilated animals. And like you said earlier, that it had been aired too soon after the 9 o'clock watershed. Well, like I say, if there's a watershed and there's a cut-off point, if it's after that, then kind of all bets are off, I'm afraid.
It's like, oh, you're 18, you go to the strip club, oh, you were a bit too close to 18 to have been allowed in.
You're either allowed or you're not. They basically also, people further complain that the presence of presenters familiar to children's programmes, basically Sarah Green was a known children's TV presenter, basically took parents off guard.
Yeah, I think it's not to underestimate the power of Sarah Green in this, because see what we say about Parky and his credibility, but the fact that she was such a kind of happy-go-lucky thing.
But apparently that was a draw. Basically,
yeah, it was a draw, completely.
Because kids said, oh, let's watch it, because Sarah Green's on it.
Yeah,
because Sarah
it was great.
Because Sarah Green was a children's TV presenter, it's almost like parents let their kids watch that because she was on it, and it's almost like that trust thing, well, if she's on it, it can't be that bad. So, again, this is all very specifically done by the BBC. You know, they'll go after us and didn't, you know, kind of deny that any... they meant any kind of malicious intentions with this, but I think
they did.
They fully meant to scare the shit out of the nation.
They did. They wanted to make a mark.
And it totally worked. This is... I mean, nothing like this can ever really happen again now.
No, definitely not now.
It was perfect. Like I say, and I just really feel privileged that I was a kid when I got to see this, because if this was airing next week, we'd watch it and we'd enjoy it, but we'd enjoy it for what it was.
Yeah.
You know, whereas as a child, I went on a complete roller coaster of this could be real, to it then being exposed as like a hoax within a hoax, where, okay, it's not real, to then scratches on a girl's face, really weird paranormal activity shit happening, and then a girl being possessed by a demon live on air. It doesn't get much better than that for me. And
watching, oh, you've got little goosebumps.
Yeah. It done me in. It was brilliant. And watching it back, I now appreciate it more as an adult. Obviously, not, I know now that it's not real, but the way the story's crafted...
Yeah, I think it's still got some quality elements in it, isn't it? It's very well put together.
Yeah, well, the way it's crafted is the really slow build-up. You know, the TV presenters kind of giving you the illusion that it's real. Then we've got people calling in from home, kind of giving their own stories about the area, which then obviously is that fantastic exposition where we kind of learn more and more about the ghost, its origin, who this guy was, and all that kind of thing.
Fresh take.
Yeah, and it was just...
And I'm surprised it's not been copied more.
Well, Blair Witch Project, people that did the writers of the Blair Witch Project cited this as something that they watched as an inspiration for the Blair Witch Project.
But I'm on about in terms of how interactive it is and stuff.
It can't be done again.
No, I'm just saying I'm surprised it's not been copied.
Yeah, obviously I don't remember any of the backlash or anything being in the papers because I was 11. I just remember watching the show, but apparently it was pretty big news because it was basically kind of on par with War of the Worlds that they did on the radio.
Yeah, so I got more in common with that myself.
Yeah, for me, it doesn't really get any better than that. It's a perfectly crafted story that scared the shit out of the nation on Halloween night, and I don't think it can ever be repeated.
I'm just not sure how people, who their listeners will go and watch it now or feel about it.
Well, no one's going to know. No one's going to go and watch it thinking it's real, are they?
No, but I mean, it won't have the same impact if you've not seen this as a child.
No, definitely.
I think you might just think, that's all right.
Well, yeah, but hopefully the listeners will just remember watching it as a kid and appreciate us chatting about it. I remember being terrified by it.
Yeah, that's on the presumption that they did watch it. That's what I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I still really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did.
Give it about an 8.
Yeah, 10.
Yeah.
I think I'd give it a 9 out of 10.
Okay.
It's pretty good. There is a behind the curtains retrospective that they've done, which I'd really like to see, because it's talking about the impact kind of 20 years on, and we've got all the original people from it again. So I'm going to try and get hold of that.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah.
Watch it.
Yeah, watch it.
Watch it and see what you think.
You can buy it on Amazon pretty cheap. Okay, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Done.
Coming up after the break, we've got the first part of our Rob Zombie retrospective. Basically, we do like an introduction before we go on to discuss House of a Thousand Corpses. So stay tuned.
Yeah, I remember her saying, I'm already dead. I'm already dead. I'm already dead. I'm already dead. Today I want you each to stand up and hold your hands in some stupid symbol. You're going to get up and scream. You're going to get up and burn an X in your head.
Thank you.
Okay, so Big Horror and Little Podcast is proud to announce its first ever guest.
Yeah, we have our first guest, and his name is Adrian Kazas. Correct pronunciation?
It's close enough.
Close enough. Well, I used to know Adrian back in the day. We used to hang out at the same sort of rock pubs, rock scene. And obviously we started up the page, and he's been interacting.
Yeah, one of the first people on there.
Yeah, and actually adding decent contribution, which we're very grateful for, that people are doing that. So yeah, I knew you were a zombie fan, Rob Zombie.
Yeah, indeed.
Not that...
both.
That too, probably, yeah.
Yeah, so he just wanted to invite you on to obviously talk about what it is about Rob that does it for you as a filmmaker.
Well, you're a fan of his music before?
Yeah, of course. Like most people, my first introduction was White Zombie, and they were a band that, when they were first around, I was really into.
Okay.
And unfortunately for me, one of the bands I never got to see live.
Right.
They were a big thing in my school. A lot of the people I hung around with were really into them. It was there was not many people in the rock scene at my school, and me being one of them, we were always the ones passing the cassettes around,
and
White Zombie were one of the first big bands, and I've only actually got to see Zombie live this year at Donington. It's the first time I've seen them.
Okay.
Really enjoyed it. A great set. It's it was a sub-headliner set on the Friday.
Okay.
And with the exception of them doing a drum solo and a guitar solo, when they probably could have put another song in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Aside from that, it was brilliant. Yeah, really good to eventually see him and eventually get down there. But now I say, obviously everything kind of stemmed from that, and House was the film that obviously introduced everyone to Rob Zombie.
So did you follow his career right from the beginning? Because I didn't really come into Halloween, and then I kind of went back.
When House came out, it was I'd heard that the film was coming out and sort of actively sought it out, went to see the pictures, and then sort of carried on from there. It's strange because actually it's on the music side of things, is solo music. While I do like it, I've never really sort of followed it that closely. His first couple of albums, but after that, never really followed. It was always the White Zombie stuff for me.
Okay. I think I worked at Rock City in '99 when he did a solo tour.
Right, okay.
And
yeah.
He walked past me on the corridor and kind of nodded at me. So I kind of met him in the corridor, but yeah.
So one of the films we're not going to talk about, something I watched just about a week ago, was The Haunted World of El Superbeast, though, on your recommendation.
Indeed.
Really bizarre.
Very bizarre.
Really good fun, though.
It's comedy all the way through, really.
Reminded me of like Ren and Stimpy kind of animation a little bit.
Yeah, it heralds that very much so. It's it initially started as a comic book by Rob Zombie.
Okay.
And he sort of followed it on from then. It actually took quite a long time to actually bring to production, because he started work on the film, on the animation, sorry, but then took on Halloween and was spending all of his time doing the first Halloween film.
Okay.
And kind of left it then to other people to finish off the animation, so it ended up taking about 3 or 4 years to actually come out.
Right.
And it was straight to DVD release in the end, I think.
Because I noted that I'll probably spot more things when I watch it again, but Michael Myers is in there, Leatherface, Brundlefly, a Medusa porn star, Werewolf Women of the SS, which is obviously the fake trailer.
That's right, from Grindhouse.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. That was in there. Jack Torrance, Nazi Zombies, Frankenstein, Phantom of the Opera.
Lots of little
ones. All the characters from House of Thousand Corpses, Devil's Rejects are in there. There's an alien chest burster, I think.
There is, yeah.
So pretty awesome for a horror fan. I was like, oh, which I think Rob Zombie kind of first and foremost is a massive horror fan, and I think you can tell.
You can tell that with a lot of his films. There are lots of little nods. And with the people he uses as well, people like Dee Wallace. I mean, a lot of people know Dee Wallace from the E.T. film, but she was in the original Howling and
Cujo
as well. Yeah, so it's good that he brings these little sort of nods to the past in with it. And as you say, you can see that in a lot of his personal films as well.
Karen Black in House of Thousand Corpses.
Ken Forey, obviously.
We do like Big Ken.
He's great. Plot synopsis is basically two teenage couples travelling across the backwoods of Texas. They're kind of looking for urban legends, aren't they? They're kind of looking for...
Yeah, writing a book on the urban legends.
So they stumble across this like Captain Spaulding's place, which obviously they think is amazing.
And we kind of know straight away that Captain Spaulding's a wrong'un.
Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly looks like a wrong'un. Yeah. I think it's a good start out for any horror film where you've got one of the main characters who, as soon as you meet him, you already know, even before any dialogue or any sort of storyline's been passed your way, you can tell that person is a little bit dodgy and is going to be sort of involved in some of the naughtiness along the way.
Yeah.
And Haig plays that really, really well, and the makeup guys did such a good job on making him ridiculously creepy.
Yeah.
And as well, the fact that it's a clown, and a lot of people really don't like clowns.
Also, just before they show that scene from when they try to rob him.
That's right.
So
yeah.
They introduce kind of how badass.
Yeah, well, that's it.
That element is before they even.
He's very good at the deadpan as well. Is a lot of the dialogue he gets is whatever he comes up against, his switch from, you know, sort of a very amicable gentleman to the person he actually is very, very swift. And
yeah. Face drops, deadly serious, and then obviously he kind of lets them go, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, he sends them down the detour.
Is that the cliche that happens in all the films where they get sent on a wrong turn? Oh, go this way, it's quicker. Or, I mean, it so happens that these guys wanted to find this venue, so he writes them a map, obviously knowing full well. And you missed it last night, didn't you? The guy shoots out the tyres.
Yeah, I mean, don't know why.
That's right, the brother. Yeah.
You miss it, though. It's like
I think it was a blink, yeah.
So then they end up at the house. Full of lunatics, don't they, basically, because they pick her up.
Pick baby up on the road.
Yeah.
Basically, I always find that first section interesting, where they're actually warned, which, again, is what you get in a lot of these films, where they're actually told, leave it alone, don't go looking for it, and they keep pressing, no, draw me a map, I want to go and see it.
I want to go.
Well, all right, well, there you go then. And
what's cool about that is map is, he's so blasé about it. I think that's such a good kind of almost red herring, because it's not like he's going, right, you must go left there, and you must go right there, because it's just like, here's the map, follow it if you want.
That's it, very vague about it.
Very vague, but knowing full well that if they do follow that map.
It's a reverse psychology thing almost, though,
I suppose,
which I thought was pretty cool.
If I pretend to be so casual, they'll never suspect a thing.
Yeah, very much so. It's he's obviously involved with the family, and he knows what lies in wait for them. But as you say, when he's so vague about it, and he doesn't so much push them that way as sort of hints at it. Tells them, no, you probably shouldn't bother with this. But then actually, all right, well, there it is. If you want to make that decision, you make that decision yourself. And, you know, it's sort of to their own doom in the end.
So obviously we pick up Baby. Now, this is kind of my first criticism. I don't think she's very good in this. I think she's a bit forced. It's a bit... And I know she's meant to be, like, really evil and stuff, but it's... kind of the all the time. I just think, just getting on my tits.
I love it.
I love it as well.
Yeah.
I like that forced side of it. I think a knock-on criticism from that, which I would take from it, is while I understand why people would not like that side or that how the character is portrayed like that, my criticism would be she doesn't carry that over enough to Devil's Rejects, the follow-up.
Okay.
I think her character is too different in the two films.
Too,
she's very sort of maniacal in the first film and really seems like she has got a screw loose, whereas in the second one she just seems a bit more brutal and bloodthirsty as opposed to being actually tapped.
So maybe that's because people did criticise her.
Quite possibly.
And she might have kind of toned it down a bit.
Yeah, I mean, the second film, while it is, I'd say, probably more brutal than the first, it does seem to be... It's not toned down, as I say, because the actual gory parts of the film are really quite unsettling in the second film.
So you were saying this, weren't you? Which you thought the first one was a bit more brutal. But
yeah,
my only thing is with the second one, I feel, is more realistic violence. And a bit more traumatising violence.
Yes, very much so.
The original is a bit hack and slash kind of, almost not cartoony, because it's quite realistic and dark.
Yeah.
But I think there's more of a serious undertone to the second one, which is almost the violence seem more kind of in your face and a bit more brutal.
Yeah, and I like House because of its escapism element of creating this horror house.
Mm. The actual house they use for the house in House of a Thousand Corpses is the best little whorehouse in Texas.
Really?
Dolly Parton and Burt Reynolds.
Is it on like a back lot somewhere?
It's on the is it Universal? It's on their lot. He's just done a horror ride, hasn't he? Zombie recently, yeah. Yeah, something like a walk-through, kind of like Ghost Train type, Ghost House type.
If it's anything like the one in House of a Thousand Corpses, it'd be awesome. It's the best thing I've ever seen. Just the weird, freaky, like, moving the way, like, the dummies, like, move forward and...
I think the freaky guy pushing the cart as well at the back, he touches
the girl's hair. Do you know who he looks like? Richard Keel. In the face.
He does, yeah. Yeah, very much so.
And I thought, are they related, or was that even him heavily made up and put a lot of weight on?
It's not Richard Keogh. It does look a lot like him.
The family all over are pretty awesome.
Yeah, I was just thinking, it's not just the structure of the house, it's the characters and the level of manic and psychotic... created.
Well.
Yeah, very much so.
Very early on at the table, to where they're too scared to leave at that point. Obviously, they're waiting for their car, but they're even there.
That's it. A lot of people would just up and walk away, or at least try to up and walk away.
But they're absolutely kind of frozen, and
it just gets getting weirder and weirder.
Yeah, and I just, there's something about that I absolutely love. And then upstairs, you've got all the cheerleaders being murdered.
Quite unnerving to see both sides, especially Otis and Baby.
In
one scene, they are, doing these terrible things to these cheerleaders and sort of having their little rants at them about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And no, please don't. Why are you doing this? Don't ask me why. How? That's a good question to ask.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He is great.
Shortstop from Texas Chainsaw Part 2. That was great, Bill Moseley.
Yeah.
He's really good. And you just believe how much of a lunatic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, he really makes this film terrifying.
Yeah.
Because he's got no boundaries to what he won't do.
No, he's got no empathy. And how do you deal with someone
who
don't? When he gets the cop law and just that long silence... where the cop is there looking at him begging, he revels in that begging situation.
That's right, with a long pan out. And I mean, again, from what I've seen of interviews about the film, studio obviously didn't like that. It's just like, no, it's too long, we don't like the music.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, it's one of their favourite parts of the film. Yeah, it's very powerful.
That actually sort of gave me that sort of feeling in the chest.
We are kind of skipping forward a bit.
That
end scene where it's the father, isn't it, one of the cheerleaders, and they open the door.
That's right,
You can totally imagine that. Like, just stumbling across this bloodbath, and one of them's still alive, and you kind of think, are they not going to get away, are they?
The
guy gets shot.
He hints it and lets you think that might be an option before, let's say, you're taken that away.
Yeah. I think good casting choice for that guy. He's actually the bloke that plays the older version of Private Ryan.
That's right,
The guy in the graveyard.
Yeah, and he's wearing pretty much the same outfit in the film.
Yes, he is.
He is, yeah.
That's a kind of standard military older person's outfit.
That's it, retired military man.
So just going back then, they're all sitting around the table. Obviously, more and more, I suppose you could call them like freaks, a member of this family. You've got the guy who plays the giant in Big Fish. Kind of heavily made up.
That's like tiny.
He's got his mask on. And then he comes out and you... Fucking hell, where the hell am I?
How does it all kick off? Because the first of all, they go through the haunted house, don't they?
Yeah.
And then they put this weird, like, cabaret thing on where a baby's doing a...
It's Betty Page, isn't it? She says,
That's right, with the dress-up and the miming to the record.
She's miming to Marilyn, though. Okay. She's kind of doing her own take on it.
Yeah. And then she flirts with...
That's it, she goes and flirts with... Bill or... No, Jerry. Flirts with Jerry and sits on his lap and his girlfriend...
He pushes her over.
Loses it, that's right.
I'm going to cut your fucking tits off!
Yeah, and then it kind of all just goes mental, isn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of like the final excuse they need to...
I do like the fact that they actually let the guys walk out. They say, right, your car's ready, off you go, get in your car, disappear.
Yeah.
And actually let them leave. Give them that sort of, they're going to get out. They're going to get out of here and get away from the family. And then, the whole scene with Otis as the scarecrow.
Yeah.
That's amazing imagery, I think.
Yeah, very much so. The way that's shot as well. And they use the stills. That works really, really well. And it makes it really quite sort of grueling, really, to watch it like that. You're the two girls still in the car.
Well, that's kind of one of my worst fears, I think, is something horrendous happening to someone I love and I can't, and I'm watching it.
Cannot do anything about it.
But
it plays on that side of it, doesn't it?
So obviously he's already used the clown imagery, and I think another one is scarecrows. It's a really good horror image. And just the fact that they're going... Because you kind of think, oh, I wonder if... wonder if there's anyone in them scarecrows. There's about a field of them, isn't there? There's probably like 10 scarecrows.
Yeah.
And obviously one jumps down, you think, oh shit, here we go. And then another one jumps down. Mm. Yeah, that's awesome imagery, that whole scene.
So then they're all, as you drag back, Dwight Schrute.
Yeah.
Really watch The American Office. Ray Wilson.
He's amazing in that.
He's amazing in that. Yeah. It's quite funny seeing him in this role. Mm. And they turn him into a mermaid, don't they?
Oh, Fish Boy. Yeah, Fish Boy.
So again, that's freaky, because he's behind the curtain the whole time.
But I think that always makes you sort of wonder about the cycle, because obviously it's very similar to things like Texas Chainsaw, where you think, well, how long have they actually been dragging people off the road and turning them into these sideshow? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because of the field, isn't there, of graves?
Bill Moseley's character Otis, he's talking about, you know, it's just, I've got a block, I'm trying to work here, I'm trying to do these things, and you coming here with your bullshit, you're putting me off. And so, yeah, it's, you wonder how long they've been there and how many people have sort of been sent to Dr. Satan's tree and dragged through the whole process that these guys are going through.
Yeah.
Because it's only recorded as 76 that I was reading this morning, catching up on the Devil's Rejects, but that's the only people who were sort of missing in that area.
Right, okay.
So goodness knows how many more
passing through. Yeah.
To get all those skeletons lined up down in sort of through the tunnels for a start.
Out of the whole film, I think that entire sort of little couple of scenes of taking them in the rabbit outfits in the coffin and lowering them into the ground, I think that is just amazing. And the way that's all shot, and obviously you've got Otis with the makeup and everything, and I think that is really quite disturbing.
Just before we talk about that really bizarre kind of final act, it's an obvious homage to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I was looking yesterday, the guy wearing the girl's father's face, basically her whole body, as a suit, it was also done in the remake of Texas Chainsaw. Leatherface puts on the mask of the girl's boyfriend, who obviously is skinned. Now, they came out in the same year, so I don't know if it was just a complete coincidence, because that doesn't happen in the original. Obviously, Leatherface is wearing a mask, but he's not wearing a mask of a victim. So I don't know if that's just a pure coincidence that happens in House of Thousand Corpses and in Texas Chainsaw, the remake, which are the same year.
Right.
So they both Silence of the Lambs a little bit.
It's been done before, the whole body suit, but the thing of like one of your loved ones
coming towards you,
being skinned and coming towards you.
So
that is brutal, very much.
Giving her a kiss. Ooh.
Yeah, well, again,
to daddy.
That's it. Well, again, a lot of, there's little bits like that, again, nods to other films. Some of those words are taken directly from Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
Give Daddy Some Sugar.
It's straight from there.
And,
it's Bill Moseley in that, isn't he, I think?
I couldn't say. But I know as well, another sort of nod is to Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is another one that comes up as well in the Halloween films. You know, the sort of kids on the road at night in the storm have to stop at the crazy house, invited in for a very bizarre meal. I mean, even though it's this sort of nod to Riff Raff, he looks very much like him. Okay. It's another one that keeps coming in with the zombie.
I thought Otis looks like Richard O'Brien.
Yeah, of course. Well, they tried to get Richard O'Brien, didn't they, for Lords of Salem?
Oh, really?
Managed to get Patricia Quinn.
It was lovely to see Patricia Quinn, isn't there, to be fair.
You pointed out about the Rob Zombie
picture show, isn't
there? It's a live concert.
Oh, is that what that
is? Yeah. Okay. It's good. It's really good. It's a great sort of mix of his stuff and old zombie stuff, and it's the whole business. It's kind of like
theatrical.
Yeah, you've got the big like walking giants and the big fire and the flames and everything. It's a really, really good show.
Dwight Maiden.
Alice Cooper as well. Yeah, he's always got some crazy thing walking around, and sort of the whole theatrical side of it. And Zombie does it. He does it well enough.
So, would you say this film is well written? I think it is.
I think it's genius.
I like it. A thing I've sort of noticed that with House and Lords as well is he's made these films with the sort of in the back of his mind, he wants to make them very similar to the style of the old films.
That's what I think. Not necessarily.
Very much so. Not necessarily just in, you know, the cinematography or the way the director, but you know, some of the dialogue, some of the script is a little bit clunky and is a little bit, you know, sort of not as smooth as you'd expect from a new production. But to me, it sounds purposeful. I think he's done that to make it like the old films. Mm. Certainly, yeah. While it's not the best film in the world, it's, you know, some of the scenes are really not done very well and some of the dialogue is not very good. But the film itself stands alone as a very, very gory and scary film.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think Zombie brings that to his films, and I see it as another nod, if you like. To,
yeah.
He's done that purposely to keep it a little bit clunky, and three quarters of the film is a build up, and then a whole load of bizarreness at the end just to get you going, which obviously comes out very much in Salem. But I think with House as well, it's I think he keeps that style, and I think he adds to it.
I really like the videos, the cutback videos, and the slowed down bits in House as well.
Yeah, very much so.
I really like that.
Yeah,
I just thought I had a problem. Just I liked all that, but the animation side of it. It just seemed a bit thrown, like shoehorned in, just random animated pictures like jumping up on the screen.
Yeah.
Same with a music video.
Well, some of it came from he filmed two versions because obviously he knew he was going to have issues with the censors.
Yeah.
He filmed sort of a bloody version and a non-bloody version.
Okay.
But then after the film, he went back and filmed some extra scenes actually at his house. He used his basement. Some of the scenes with Otis and the cheerleaders. Some of the more sort of disturbing scenes with the cheerleaders, and as well with Baby and where she's naked in the bed with the corpse and things like that. A lot of those were filmed afterwards.
In Rob Zombie's basement.
Yeah. So he's like, invite him over to the house and, do the film in there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, certainly a lot of the scenes where you've got the sort of the normal scale and the red scale filming where you've got a lot of the red lights and the effects like that.
Yeah.
Those were initially shot separately because he knew he was going to have issue with the sensors. So he was going to use certain ones for certain scenes, but they ended up using both and sort of, you know, masking them over the top of each other.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking that's the sort of thing that makes this film unique and above other films that have attempted to do this style.
Yeah, definitely.
The fact that it has individuality on it. And
addressing that criticism people like have that. About it being a music video, if you didn't know Rob Zombie was a music guy,
exactly.
Would you have the same criticism? I don't know if people are only using that because they know how easy the music videos.
Yeah, maybe.
If they didn't know that, you'd just go, oh, that's really cool, that. Because Quentin Tarantino does shit like that all the time.
He does.
Yeah.
Nobody whinges.
Not a problem.
That's exactly what I thought. I thought about Kill Bill. And the use of cartoon imagery and stuff like that. And
yeah, very much so. Mm. And the use of such, you know, such brutal images in that sort of style as well. Because again, you know, people like Tarantino, obviously a lot of his films are very violent and there's lots of blood. And, you know, but I think it's only certainly the last 10 years, but probably 10, 15 years where films aren't just brutal for the sake of brutal, they're just becoming more real. Because apart from the sort of bizarre Dr. Satan end bit that you get with House, a lot of the film is real life. There are weird people, you know, and certainly as weird as the people you see in this film.
Yeah.
You know, there are bizarre people who live out in the hills and have a certain way of living. And whether they are psychotics or not is kind of irrelevant. People like that exist. People,
families
like that, and people like Captain Spaulding, people are that brusque and can turn on a dime and sort of be sound with you 1 minute and then really not very pleasant the next. And I just see that as coming through in films, as that realism. A lot of people say, oh no, well it's too brutal. Well, I'm sorry, but life's fucking brutal. It is. It's you know, it's, you can't have these polished films and, oh well, they take the wrong turn and go down here and someone gets a knife in the chest and there's not that much blood on the floor. Life isn't like that. They're actually showing
people,
they're showing things
like orifices.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dying or dead.
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, a certain part of it is showing life as it is, as opposed to the sort of fantasy side of it.
I was just going to say that I think there's a couple of things stolen from Rob Zombie, and I think one of them is obviously when you see Dr. Satan doing his work, cigarette burns, the angel type thing, but in cigarette burns, looks exactly the same kind of spooky character.
Okay.
It's almost like they've took it from that and put that into that.
Yeah, unless that cigarette burns out and both took it from some other kind of
industry. We have to check the history on that. Yeah.
Possibly. He looks quite a lot like the crypt keeper as well, Dr. Satan.
Yeah.
Tales from the Crypt.
And so when we watched Dr. Fibes, his little clockwork band looks just like Frank Sidebottom.
I can see that.
But I don't know if Frank Sidebottom has copied not Dr. Fibes, but something else.
Right,
he doesn't cite Dr. Fibes as inspiration for that. So it could be one of them things where it's like a well-known mythological kind of creature thing that all films have kind of borrowed from, maybe. I'm not sure.
But it was like they could have just took that and put those broken wings. Have you seen the cigarette burns?
The John Carpenter one. Mm. About the videotape.
Which I couldn't stop laughing at for some reason.
And it's like, it's this videotape that's kind of basically been created by the devil itself.
Right.
It's so horrendous that everybody goes mad watching it.
Oh, kind of like a Ring type thing.
Kind of.
And I think, the guy is like a collector. And one of his things that he's like collected is this just like strange...
Well, it's a fallen angel from the movie, and in the movie he gets his wings taken off and stuff, and he's left a sort of a shriveled over, sort of long-haired creature there. And I just really noticed that when I saw that yesterday. Yeah. I thought that looks just like that freaky thing from Cigarette Burns. My general copy and thing, I'm going to leave till the end, but I think he's influenced. I think I'll mention it more in Lord of the Salem.
Okay, just talking about how he has these issues with the senses. How do you feel about him using crowdfunding to do his latest
for 31? It's a great idea. Yeah, I think any sort of mass effort like that to actually get projects off the ground, I think that's fine.
Do you not think Rob Zombie could fund that himself?
Quite possibly. Quite possibly.
He's scared that it might go wrong and then he doesn't want to lose his own money, because that's what a lot of people are saying.
You could say that, yeah. I mean, because there was initially talk of him doing another remake. Apparently he got hold of the rights to do Children of the Corn. Okay. And he was going to remake that. But then again, he always said after H1 that he wasn't going to do another remake, and then ended up going back and doing two. But I suppose on the back of the fact of how successful it was. Mm. I mean, the Halloween remake by Rob Zombie is the most successful film in the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're going to talk about that in a bit. I can't wait, because it's kind of the one I'm looking forward to.
It's fantastic, yeah. But no, I mean, I can see that criticism coming from people saying, well, yeah, he thinks he might fall flat on his arse and lose his own money. That's fine, maybe. But also, the other side of it is a lot more films are doing the crowdfunding thing now, and it does get people involved. You know, people can get a credit on the film. People can actually become an extra on the film. And yeah, I think fair play to them, get people involved in it. Everything's becoming more sort of social with the media and things now. Everyone getting involved. Get people involved with the film. Get them in there, and never know. One of these people might be the next director or actor or writer or whatever.
Just give them a little foot in the door.
Absolutely.
It depends how you look at it, whether you look at it skeptically or not. He's either preserving his own money or he's trying to give back.
You're not getting anything from it, though, are you?
But you're getting something back by helping others and bringing them into something.
You've got to think, if people aren't going to give him the funding to do the film he wants to make, then, again, in your case, he could probably more than likely afford to do it himself. But you've got to look at other ways to do it. If he's not going to get that from, the big companies, if they're not going to give him the money.
Because I don't want to see a film that a studio paid Rob Zombie to make. I want to see a film that Rob Zombie wants to make.
He wants to make. That's a fair comment.
Because this is the problem, isn't it? The sense is just fucking on the field day. It's annoying.
Rip everything to pieces.
It doesn't need to be like that.
No, you get that with everything. And I think one of the sort of little sound bites or quotes about some of the interviews he's had for House is that, he wants to make films where people don't think everything is okay, that anything can go wrong at any minute. And the big companies don't want to make that. They want the one person to leave at the end with the head held high. That's not real life. That's not how it is.
So ethically, I'm not 100% sure how I feel about the crowdfunding thing, but from a fan point of view, I want to see Rob Zombie make a film where he can do what the fuck he wants.
Especially with
this 31. Have you ever seen the film, the game Manhunt?
Manhunt.
Where it's just basically you're stuck in like an arena almost with people that are trying to kill you.
Right, okay.
And I think that's kind of what 31 is going to be.
Excellent.
It's five.
Up to date Running Man.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Yes, which is,
that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, it's sounds great. One thing also we talked about last night was how Rob Zombie films are full-on 18 certificate. Obviously not in America, but in England. It's quite rare now that a film comes out, and unless it's got quite brutal sexual violence, then it manages to get an 18 certificate. Rob Zombie's films all seem to be 18 certificate. And I think that's great, because you don't get the dumbing down to get the bums on seats
I agree with you.
You make something in a 12A.
Too many films have gone that way and ended up being shitty films. It's... probably shouldn't admit it too loud, but I'm quite a fan of the film Alien vs. Predator. It's a great film. It would have been 200% better if it was an 18, but the film itself is very good, and too many films are going that way, as you say, to fill the cinemas up and get people's money.
Yeah. Expendables 3.
I've not seen any of those. I've managed to avoid them like the plague, to be honest with you.
Well, just because I'm a huge fan of, from growing up, Arnie, Stallone.
No, same. Same, I am. But it's,
and
I'm
they
just
are pretty
not
good. The first one was good. It had some shitty CGI blood, but violence-wise, it was pretty full-on. And the second one was a little bit less. And then the third one was, in England, I think, a 12A. So if you went with your mum and dad, you take a 12-year-old there, and I think, fucking hell.
No, it's
and hopefully they'll bring out like a number, because you can see where the violence is cut. You can see where, if it was the first one, you would have seen the head back of the head fly off.
Right,
And you can see where the gun shoots, and then it cuts to a different scene, almost like it's off.
The pasted over it.
You're taking it out again.
No, too much of that. Yeah,
with crowdfunding, we're guaranteed to get a full on 18 certificate.
Yeah, no, very much so.
I'm all for that.
I just think that he manages to create something that is really complicated for the mind to sort of handle unless you're experienced with horror and you're open to the realities
of
the horrific sides of life. If you're uncomfortable with anything of the dark side of life, you're not going to enjoy his film. They're going to leave a real lasting kind of, you'd be thinking about that for days.
I think if you're going to introduce someone to horror, you wouldn't do it with a Rob Zombie film. You'd wait a few, maybe a few months.
Yeah,
definitely.
On something a bit gentle.
Yeah, ease them in gently.
No. I watched House when I was like younger, so I was like 22, 23, and it really stayed with me. That point, I'd not gone to the extent. I watched horror stuff growing up, but there was something about that.
As we mentioned before, not necessarily the imagery, but certainly the sort of the feel of the film. It makes you uncomfortable, certain parts of it. Not just that someone's, you know, sort of being hacked up or whatever, but certainly the performances
that the family love each other as well. There's always that in there.
Yeah, the family love each other, and the family think they're living, you know, a decent country life. Yeah. It's what they do. It's the grown up doing that, and they obviously care a lot for each other, and as shows in that and in Devil's Rejects, you know, they're sort of go to the ends of the earth, as you do for your family.
Yeah.
It just so happens that they're all fucking mental.
Yeah.
Absolutely mental.
One more question I just wanted to ask you before we kind of wrap this one up. Obviously, you've got young kids.
Indeed.
And Sophie's, obviously.
Sophie's just 18 as well,
What age would you feel happy showing your kids, first of all, just horror in general, but secondly, like a Rob Zombie film, if your kids went, oh, I really want to watch Devil's Rejects, at what point would you go, you're not watching that until you're at least...
Well, it would depend on the film, obviously. Certainly, I would agree that some of the sort of gorier ones, that on the side of things, looks quite gory. The first horror film I ever showed Sophie was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and she was 14.
Okay,
and then Poltergeist, and then sort of. And the only reason we picked Texas is she don't like masks, so we thought it was a good place to start.
I love Texas. It's one of my favourite films.
It's got one of my favourite scenes in it. The scene where she's just running away and just gets out the door before he grabs her. You've got that hopelessness of, I'm there!
She's flying.
Just get grabbed. And then straight from that to one of the probably most iconic scenes from the film, where he just takes her into the back and bangs her on a meat hook, and she's just there alive. Just that little sort of 1-2 minute segment is just so brutal.
It's the great thing about Texas Chainsaw. There's no fucking blood in that film.
No.
It's all kind of in your mind. You know, the guy gets bashed on the head. You don't really see any blood. She gets hung on a meat hook.
Yeah.
But you don't need to see.
And again, it's that uncomfortable thing. It makes you uncomfortable.
The camera goes to her face as the hook sinks in.
That's right.
Ribs and, oh God.
Yeah, I mean, you just imagine how that feels, can't you?
It's just horrible. And the fact that you see her, you know, alive on the hook, it's not just, you know, a body on a hook's a body on a hook, but when that person's moving around and shouting and things, that makes it a little bit more, oh, actually, she's...
And I think even the strongest of people would not be able to pull themselves off that. No, you'd like to think you could, but your hands would just slip.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Far, be able but to it's totally, yeah. Back on to the terms of the age, I think it depends on how you raise your kids in terms of open mind, alternative lifestyle as well, and their understanding.
Yeah, it can do, it can do. I mean, you know, the difference is nowadays, you know, a lot of kids' films have reasonably adult content in them. I don't necessarily mean sort of sexually or, you know, horror-wise, but a lot of sort of Disney films and Pixar films deal with emotional issues,
yeah,
and
so they are quite bubbling.
Yeah, and they are quite adult. So kids are now introduced to that a lot earlier than they were sort of in the sort of 60s, 70s, and 80s, like when we grew up. It was, you know, kids' films were kids' films. You had the occasional sort of big films that came through, like E.T., as mentioned earlier. That was very emotional there, but kids went to see that film, so that sort of, they got that quite early.
E.T. was a ruiner, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember sat in Savoy Cinema on Derby Road, blarting at that one when I was a kid. Yeah, very much so.
If that was on now, I might still leave the room when it just to avoid it.
Might water up a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, kids do get a lot of that a lot earlier nowadays. And as I say, I think it does make a difference of how you bring your children.
I think it's sexual violence for me that I would have an issue with showing.
Yeah, no, very much so.
Yeah, I mean, that kids understand what was happening.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean that's a big sort of taboo on its own. Whether, you know, just sex, never mind sexual violence. It's you have to be very careful with that. Certainly, if that's their first introduction to something like that, you know you don't want to be showing horrible scenes.
Yeah, this is obviously the rape scene, which in Halloween, which we'll talk about, and that's quite brutal.
So let's just kind of talk about the last scene, and before we wrap this bit up.
Yeah.
Are these all meant to be Dr. Satan's creations? Because obviously the film's fairly realistic up until that last kind of 5 minutes, and then it just goes a bit fucking mental.
It does go very crazy.
Yeah.
Which is cool, but I think it's a bit of a tone shift.
Yeah.
So I mean, once you get to the bottom of that pit, and she kind of goes through the little corridor, and
it's a tone shift, but that's just what I think I said earlier on. This film's always been like a bit of an escapism piece. That has an element of, once they enter the house, for me, it creates a tone that just progresses. And I think once she gets down, for me, that's kind of like, if you were reading a book, that would fit. I could imagine reading a horror novel.
Yeah,
and
it's building to that crazy crescendo.
So in terms of writing,
end.
For me, it's written as a book would be written,
right?
Which for me is the best writing of all. And so I know it kind of feels like a tonal shift, but the whole thing's got a trip feel to it. Anyway.
Yeah, and I agree with that, definitely.
Like a psychedelicness to it.
And I think as well, as we talked earlier about this sort of nod to the way the old films were made. This whole premise of having 2/3 of a film, which is, you know, some little grim bits in there, but sort of a build up, and then the last third or quarter of the film is just utter random weirdness. I like that side to it.
Like I say, I do like it. I can just see why some people kind of think, well, yeah, what the fuck are these creatures meant to be? But it's like a bit of a...
Oh, the guy's all sat around on the sofa at the bottom.
The skin guy.
Yeah, yeah. I think some of them are Dr. Satan's creations, and some of them will be the inmates from the Institute that was initially there.
Yeah.
The Dr. Satan was initially from the Mental Institute, wasn't he? He did all the experimenting.
Yeah.
So some of them would be the hangers-on from there, and you would think some of them would be the people that dragged in off the street and made into fishbowl.
That was just so much more horrendous that's your life that you've been resigned to, becoming a flesh-hungry thing.
Yeah,
you're part of it.
Even the guy in the rabbit suit, he's just so creepy. The guy wandering around the tunnels when she first gets dropped down there, and he's just been there. You think, oh yes, it's Jerry. It's like, oh, it's not Jerry. And then you see how old he is and how grimy he is. It's like, oh, he's been there a long time. Mm. You're not actually going anywhere.
Yeah,
there's something like that's your worst nightmare.
And then the final scene, because I kind of said to Rachel, why doesn't she recognise Captain Spaulding? And it's like, well, because they didn't know he's part of it, did they?
No,
well,
no,
he just sends them
on their merry way. He's not got his makeup on, which could be one thing, but as well, yeah, they they don't know he's involved at all.
As far as he's concerned, he just sent them, he just gave them what they needed.
Yeah, and then they left because they were all ready. Oh, we want to go, let's get out of here, we don't want to go on the ride. But then they did the ride anyway, yeah. They're all ready to leave. So
she's
yeah.
She's so traumatised, and she just played the trauma. I always say about people aren't traumatised enough, but I think that's another thing. She is very traumatised by the end of that. When she gets into the car, she's blinded, actually, at that point.
Absolutely.
Where you're so scared.
She doesn't seem to be actually looking at him. She's just, there's a car, someone's going to get me in here and get me out of here.
It's kind of the thing, unlike the first time when you think they're going to leave, we know she's fucked because it's Captain Spaulding driving. Obviously, she doesn't know.
She doesn't know. And then when I just
to make it even worse, just like it wasn't bad enough that Captain Spaulding is over, he pops up and the film ends.
Yeah.
Mr. Otis, bless him.
Yeah. Which is quite a fitting end. Hollywood seems to like happy endings. My dad loves a bloody happy ending. He's not interested unless they even get away at the end.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like I say, it's not real life. People don't get away.
No, and I think it's good how with Devil's Rejects follow-up, he didn't... He followed up the story because obviously, you know, the Firefly family are there, but he didn't just follow straight on from that. He didn't make someone survive and come back and escape. And no, it's good not to see that. It's nice to get an ending to it and find out what happens to them. The fact that they do end up getting away and chased by the policeman's brother. But yeah, it's not a direct follow on. Oh, one of them managed to knock a wall down accidentally and escape. And yeah, they took it in that little bit of an extra direction, which I liked.
Cool. So ratings, we do out of 10. So anything up to 1 to 5 is kind of a failure of the movie. 6 to 10 is anything from I liked it to it's a masterpiece. And okay. If you want to do an 8 plus or a 7 plus or a 6 plus, it's so slow, you know, it's not quite a 10. You might think it's a 9 plus.
If right,
you
okay, yeah.
So let's go yours first, because I kind of know what I know
what Razor's going to say. House, I'd certainly give a solid 8 to House. I think it's a very good film. I really like it. I think it's very well made, and I do like all the little nods to certainly, you know, 70s horror cinema and all the nods to various other films that he's obviously taken influence from. So 8 plus. Let's go 8 plus.
Well, mine's an 8. I do think it's really solid. I mean, for something to get a 9 or a 10 for me, I mean, I can probably count on 2 hands how many films I've given a 10 to in the horror genre. So yeah, for me, 8's a solid flick. I think it's great.
9.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty high. I realised watching it again yesterday that I'd watch it again today. And there's something, obviously, because I work within mental health and, if, you know, fascinates me, and I kind of explore to the deepest, darkest end as well as sort of the light. And there's just something about it that is just, you know, it's not quite a masterpiece, but it's excellent. At what it does.
It is an excellent film.
And the fact that there's so many nods to the classics and so much imagery in there, I just love it, so it's a 9 for me.
Okay, awesome. So that's that wrapped up.
Okay.
Okay, brilliant.
Looking for something to fill that deep, horrible, dirty void inside? Then look no further than the podcast Under the Stairs. Join your host, Duncan McLeish, and guests as they dissect horror films, old and new. No film is too gory. No film is too scary. No film is too violent for the podcast Under the Stairs. The podcast Under the Stairs can be found at podcastunderthestairs.wordpress.com or on iTunes. The podcast Under the Stairs is a proud member of the League of Extraordinary Podcasts. To avoid fainting, keep repeating to yourself, it's only a podcast. It's only a podcast. It's only a podcast.
Okay, so welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that first chat about Rob Zombie, talking about House of a Thousand Corpses. Parts 2 and 3 are going to come up in subsequent episodes. Mm. Where we're going to talk about the Halloween remake and then finish off with Lords of Salem. So obviously this is going to be relatively short show compared to what we do normally, because we have been a bit scattered with recording.
Yeah, we have.
What we watched, and but we're going to start recording and making a note of what we watched leading up to Halloween.
Yeah, we're watching, keeping an October list.
Yeah.
And then what we'll do is we'll read the list out, and then we'll pick probably a few movies just to, that we really enjoyed the most, probably out of them all.
Yeah.
That we've watched.
Yeah, I mean, I want to start watching some of the original Halloween movies.
Yeah.
Probably 1, 2 and 4, maybe H2O.
Because you watched 3 last night, didn't we?
Yeah, we watched Season of the Witch, actually, last night, which, obviously, back in the 80s, expecting another Michael Myers movie was probably really fucking disappointing.
Mm.
I can imagine being gutted as a fan. But obviously, as a standalone movie,
yeah, it's.
I think it's a really good film.
I enjoyed it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. Tom Atkins drinking his way through.
Drinking and shagging. I was like, no way would he pull on that easily. It was like he was Roger Moore as Bond.
And I know, just going, yeah, hello.
When yeah, and she was like, oh, I'll take my knickers all off. Over him.
The only, my only criticism to that is, which I thought was a bit stupid, the end scene where obviously it turns out that she's been replaced by a robot. Why did she help him escape?
Yeah, then? It doesn't add up.
Yeah, it doesn't add up. She helps him escape and then it turns out she's a robot and she tries to kill him. Well, she should have just stopped him.
Yeah.
In the first place.
And also when he's on the phone to the TV companies, pull it, as if they'd listen to him.
Yeah.
You'd think he was just a madman, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course you would, but they don't pull it, which is a really good fuck you ending, actually.
Yeah, because they keep it on one channel, don't they?
Yeah, I think for like 1982, to kind of let the audience believe that there were entire worlds, or I don't know if it's just America's population of kids, are all killed.
They get their faces melted in.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, good film. So yeah, we're watching some of the other Halloweens, the Michael Myers ones. I probably won't watch 5 and I won't watch 6 and I definitely won't watch Resurrection. but yeah, I'll probably be watching the others. Might watch Trick or Treat again. Give that another go, because I wasn't that keen on that when I first watched it. You liked it, didn't you?
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
But I've heard a lot of people talking about how good it is, so I'm going to give it another shot.
Yeah. Rewatches are worth it, aren't they, sometimes?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely. I've rewatched quite a few things recently.
Say, we rewatched something. Well, it was Lord. Well, we saw Lord of Salem.
Yeah, we rewatched Lord of Salem. Really enjoyed it the second time. But yeah, we'll talk about that when it comes on. Obviously, you'll hear our retrospective. We watched Cold in July.
Yeah.
Which is not really a horror film, but as such.
It's Dexter's return to the screen.
Yeah, Michael C. Hall. It's a really good film. I didn't see. It takes a good couple of twists and turns that you're not expecting.
Yeah, and obviously I had high hopes for it because Duncan had watched it and was raving about it.
Yeah.
But I still really enjoyed it. Didn't disappoint.
Disappoint at all. Yeah, totally delivered on the promise.
Yeah, it wasn't predictable at all in any way.
Yeah.
And great performances from obviously Michael, but Don Johnson's really great in it too. And
yeah, he is great.
And the other guy.
Yeah.
Crazy, I can't remember
the name of the actor, but yeah, basically all round parts.
All three of them were great, really.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed that.
It's not a horror per se, it's more thriller horror, but some of the content is horrific.
Oh, yeah, when you find those videos.
Battering porn stars.
Batting practice, yeah. Yeah, really pretty horrendous. So, activity on the page, we've had a few new people, but we want a few more.
Yeah.
Come and join our page, please. We're not going to bombard your feed with just a load of shit.
I occasionally share a story from somewhere, but that's not all the time, and I try to personalise.
Yeah, and we just want to keep you up to date on kind of episodes and that kind of thing, so please come and join our page, if only just so we know that we've got some fans more than anything else.
I think, yeah, because you know, if nobody does still, we just think, oh. But we're still going to carry on anyway.
Yeah.
Because we're very appreciative of the people that are listening.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We have got a nice little fan base and we really appreciate people's involvement.
We realise we're not for everyone.
Yeah, probably not.
But,
congratulations to Jamie Wilson.
Oh, yeah, he got married.
Not only on winning the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But also getting married.
Yeah.
Which is probably better than winning the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But well done all the same, mate. Hope you enjoyed that movie.
Do we need to give anything away this time?
No, I'm not giving anything away this
time. We'll give something away on the Halloween special, though.
We will. Yeah, we'll give away a Blu-ray or maybe a DVD, because I don't know if everyone's kind of converted to Blu-ray. So I think we might be eliminating quite a few people by just offering a Blu-ray.
Well, also, we've converted most things to Blu-ray, and we have a lot of mint condition DVDs, don't we?
Yeah.
So we thought we might sort of group them, give three away them as a prize at a time.
Give a few DVDs away for people. So, yeah, we'll have a question coming up in the next few episodes. So I think that's about it for today.
Yeah.
So thanks for kind of hanging in, because I know we've not been on air for a while and this has been a relatively short show, but hopefully we'll be back on form for Halloween.
Yeah, so Halloween special will obviously be the second part of the Rob Zombie Halloween, which ends up as a Halloween comparison.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'm going to record a special with that girl, Laura Rachel Woods, that has actually just posted some spooky haunted house picture of, and that's going to be about what her, how she feels about her favourite haunted, sort of haunting film and one that didn't work for her.
Yeah.
And we'll just fill the rest of the shizzle up. But, but we, yeah, probably be about 3 hours long. So.
Oh, yeah, and my top, basically, my top 10 exploding decapitation, blowing up heads.
Five were meant to happen on this one.
Five were meant to happen on this show, but I'm going to do it as 15. I'm basically doing a top five decapitations, a top five shotgun head explosion blasts, and then a top five just exploding heads. So that's going to appear things like scanners, where it's not a shotgun, it's not an explosion, it's just some kind of supernatural thing has made someone's head explode. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and we'll see you all soon.
Bye. Bye.